climate and the Columbia Rivers provide sustenance, recreation, and economic benefits to our region. Yet these rivers are burdened with the legacy of industrial pollution and threatened with the future of toxic contamination. The Two Rivers, One City event will bring a broad network of river users together to share their stake in clean water. The event will include an overview of the various environmental justice issues related to the Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup and the oil-by-rail projects along the Columbia. Again, that's Two Rivers, One City, Tuesday, September 9th at the Charles Jordan Community Center, 9009 North Foss Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kvu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you very much. So I grew up in Queens, New York, and whenever I fly home, my father will still pick me up at the airport, which is really sweet of him. And this happened a couple of years ago. I land at LaGuardia Airport, I get my bags, I'm walking towards the car, when this lady I'd never seen before runs in front of me, gets into the back of our car. Now that, of course, is strange, because that's never supposed to happen. So I opened the door, I said, "Excuse me, miss." Before I finish, she cuts me off. She says, "Look, I'm sorry, but I got here first. Maybe you should walk a little faster." At this point, it becomes clear that she thinks she's in a cab and my father is a cab driver. Because apparently she's so racist, she looks at the color of the driver before looking at the color of the car. Well, clearly. Clearly, he has the markings of the servant class. Drive me.
I'm Sari Kametha, sitting in for Dimay Roberts, and this is Stage and Studio. You were just listening to one of my favorite jokes by comedian Hari Kondabolu, our guest today. Hari Kondabolu is a New York-based comedian with community organizing ties to Seattle. He's known most for his political style of comedy, and he was a writer for Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. This year, this academic year, he will be New York University's APA Artist in Residence. He released his first album, which is called Waiting for 2042, which is on sale now. This is Stage and Studio. And I feel you tugging. Hari, welcome to Stage and Studio.
Hello, how are you?
Great, and welcome back to KBOO as well.
Yeah, it's been, I think the last time we chatted was 2-3 years ago already. It's been a while.
It's been a while, and a lot has happened since then.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of shows. I've been traveling around the country. I've done some TV work. You know, it's still nice, though. Like, the idea that I can just come back to the Northwest fairly regularly, like, that's still a big part of my life, and so it's nice, you know, regardless of whatever else is on the docket now, I still have time for the Northwest. Like, I love the Northwest, so it's great.
Absolutely. And before I forget, I want to remind our listeners that Hari Kondabolu will be performing in Portland live September 26th and 27th at the Helium Comedy Club. So let's...
It's the 25th to the 27th, so 25th... there's a Thursday show as well.
Oh, excuse me, 25th, 26th, and 27th. That is 3 days of opportunities for folks to come see you live. So first, as I mentioned in the introduction, your background includes community organizing, human rights, and comedy. And I think for some time you were working in these areas in parallel. And a few years ago you left, or that is to say you became a full-time comedian. How did you come to this decision?
It was hard. I mean, I got discovered when I was working in Seattle as an immigrant rights organizer. And I did comedy at night. It's something I've always loved to do. And doing it in Seattle proved to be wonderful because it was a small scene and it was a very supportive scene. So I could work during the day. And especially when you're working on immigrant rights organizing or any kind of organizing, you know, emotionally, especially when you're hearing people's stories and working on cases, that can be very emotionally trying. Like, comedy was always a great release. And all of a sudden, you know, I was starting to get a following, and I got discovered by the HBO Comedy Festival, and eventually I got on Jimmy Kimmel Live. And I had this career that I didn't really intend on having. You know, it was something I loved to do. It was a passion. It was a I guess saying it was a hobby is kind of an understatement, because I put a lot of time into it, but certainly it was a passion, but not something I thought I could do professionally. And all of a sudden, you know, I got into this HBO Comedy Festival. I got on Jimmy Kimmel Live. I got a manager. I got all the infrastructure to start being a professional comedian. And I decided to go to grad school instead to get a master's in human rights. And my plan was to, you know, that was the plan all along, is to get a human rights framework to the organizing I was doing, and then just be a, you know, learn to be a stronger organizer. And, you know, instead, like, you know, I got the degree, but, you know, while I was there, you know, I missed comedy a lot. And I, even while I was in London and not performing, I got the chance to perform on TV again. Like, I flew out during my year to, after not performing for 6 months, to be on Comedy Central to do a show called Live at Gotham. And to me, it was like, okay, it's something I'm not pursuing, but even when I'm not pursuing it, I'm getting opportunities. And I keep getting emails from people saying that they really appreciate what I do, and I had a unique voice. And it was an indication that, like, this thing that I've always dreamed of but never thought was really possible was possible. And just because there weren't that many South Asians, I mean, that was like 7-8 years ago. Which is amazing. When I think about 7 minutes, it's already been that long. But there's so many more South Asians in the media now, but even, you know, as recently as 7 or 8 years ago, there weren't that many. But it felt like, if people are saying that this is not an issue, in fact, it's part of the excitement, and there's somebody with a unique voice and a unique look, and people are interested in that, to me, it was like, well, I'm proud of what I have to say, and if the opportunity is there now, I don't know how long it's going to be there for. I don't know how hard, you know, and also the opportunity to push yourself, you know, like, you know, I think in some ways it's easy and comfortable to make your art in Seattle and Portland, and certainly great work comes out of there. But when you really want to push yourself and you know, be around, like, the great performers of your, and the great artists of your particular craft, like, you know, I was getting that opportunity. So I went for it. You know, and I you know, sometimes I still think about organizing, whether what I left on the table and what I could have contributed to that world. And, but, you know, I'm proud of the kind of work I do, and I'm excited that I still get to do it.
Definitely. And it's interesting, I didn't realize the timing that a lot of the infrastructure to pursue comedy professionally was falling into place as you had decided to go to graduate school, because that is, graduate school is a commitment that is beyond, above and beyond the full-time commitment. So, and to leave performing for a year while you were overseas. That's interesting. I didn't realize that timing.
Yeah, it was hard. You know, it's I think I also realized that I kept writing. I never stopped writing. And I just imagined the time when I was going to be able to actually do the stuff I've been writing and see how it goes. And to find out if any of it is funny. It makes you, I don't think I realized how much I needed to write and perform until I wasn't able to. And as an adult, I think about, you know, I've thought about what it means to write and perform. And, you know, comedy to me isn't just something I enjoy doing. It's how I communicate. You know, even with friends, if you take out the actual performance aspect, like with friends and family, that's, you know, my closest friends and my family, we communicate through jokes. Through finding, like, you know, making our points through a joke or through finding something funny in a moment, like, that's how we deal with the world. In addition, that's how we have fun, but that's how we communicate. I don't know how else to communicate.
So speaking of which, the joke that we began this program with was the one about a white woman climbing into your dad's car, assuming your dad was a cab driver in New York City. I mean, it's one of my favorites that you tell, and sometimes it's like, did this really happen?
Yeah, it really happened.
So I believe you. I totally. I was curious.
The moments where I start to think that I was meant to be a comedian when ridiculous things like that happen, and I realize, and I have a platform to actually, you know, and some of it that makes the job easier, because all I really need to do at that point is tell the story. And then, you know, there's like, she didn't actually run at the end of it, but, you know, in my version she does, because it needs to go somewhere, you know. I mean, that's the thing with comedy, you have your truth, and then you kind of try to create something that's more interesting and bigger and try to get to a bigger point and mm-hmm. cut to other ideas. But, you know, I feel like all these ridiculous or awful things that have happened, you know, they end up being the base for a lot of material that turns into something else. And luckily, the most outrageous parts are the truth there. So it's like I didn't really have to do all that much other than make it a structure it like a joke.
Right. Well, I was curious, how did your dad respond to this circumstance?
He wasn't upset. I mean, that was always kind of something that was interesting to me because I obviously was furious. And he was like, you know, he treated it as if it's a thing that happens. Maybe it has happened to him before and I didn't know. But, like, he was like, oh, no, she just got, you know, thought I was, you know, was a cab driver. And I'm like, yeah, that's something to be upset about. And he didn't get upset by it. You know, maybe for me, it's maybe it was an othering. You know, like to me,
right.
I thought it's like you see us in only a particular way, and you saw this context, and you read that much into it. You know, like I say in the joke, like she looked at the color of the driver before looking at the color of the car. Like it didn't look like a cab; it didn't have any markings, and this was pre Uber and pre Lyft. You know,
mm-hmm.
so. There was, which apparently that happens more often now and maybe seems a bit more reasonable now, but this was before those ride-sharing things, so it was kind of like there was no reason other than your stereotypes. And for me, I feel like I have this sense of ownership over being American and over being, we are part of this, and you can't prejudge us. And not to say if I was an American or if I was visiting, anyone deserves that treatment. But there is a degree, to me, of a buildup, right? Of, like, time and time again being treated like I don't have an ownership of identity. Like, I'm not part of the fabric of the society.
Absolutely.
And to me, this is another example of it. Like, oh, you make your prejudgment and you act on it and you feel entitled. And to my father, maybe to him, it, you know, that part of him still doesn't see it as quite his country. You know, he's not a citizen. He, you know, still thinks of India as home. And my mom, who was also born in India, she became a citizen. And not to say that you need to be a citizen in order to see America as your home and feel like you're an American, but certainly she's bought into certain aspects a bit more. But for my father, you know, maybe part of it is that, like, if she certainly doesn't expect to be, you know, the victim of discrimination or prejudice, but I think he takes it differently than I do.
I think there's definitely some truth to that with generations, and especially if, you know, these folks came as immigrants versus, you know, people like you and I who were born and bred up here, and yeah, the lifetime of othering and things like that. I wanted to quickly go back to what you were talking about before. As a comic who, you know, this was only 7 or 8 years ago as you were getting started, and there weren't many South Asian American comics, and now we're seeing, or that is to say, even performers, we're seeing now a lot more representation in media. And also how this ties into you being a writer for Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. Tell us about that experience a little bit.
I mean, it was great. I mean, well, on the first point, like, it's been incredible to see the greater representation, more voices. Like, it's as simple as just seeing people with my skin tone, you know, like, that's exciting, and on a basic level, and darker, you know, like, mm-hmm. it's, and I think for those folks who, you know, for the kids who grew up with everybody, like, you don't know, like, 10 years ago, like, it was just some stereotypes. There was Apu, there was white people playing us, like, mm-hmm. it wasn't the idea that you could have your own voice and exist you know, in work that you create, and that's new. And as well as, like, you know, the idea of Aziz and Mindy Kaling, you know, being people who have a degree of power and control over what they want in their careers, that's also exciting. So that's incredibly, you know, wonderful. Totally Biased, I think, was a very unique opportunity because, you know, I got to work for my friend W. Kamau Bell, an incredible comedian, somebody I'm proud to call a friend. And he gave a lot of us our first opportunities writing, and it was a very diverse writer's room. many different people of color, you know, queer folks, like really like a unique kind of situation. And what was great about the show is, again, this was Kamau's first, you know, real TV job as well. So that's the other thing. Like, he was very generous with that, you know, with that being considered, because if there was an angle that we would pitch to him for a story and he didn't feel like it could genuinely come out of his mouth, because it sounds like, oh, you know, that's a South Asian story, and you certainly have a perspective that, you know, even if I shared, I wouldn't have the same fire for or do as well, I think you should do it. So he would have his writers perform. And I think that's...
Right, I remember seeing that.
That's just an extraordinary kind of thing. Like, you know, on your first show, you want other people to have a part of it. And that's part of his spirit, and it's always been part of his spirit of sharing the ball. You know, everybody gets to play, and everybody has contributes, and that's part of his greater mission. And certainly, you know, as you know, he as a cis heterosexual black male saying you know, things that are very progressive minded and forward thinking and, you know, with vision, like, I think that certainly has a great deal of value. But there's also a value with having people share their truths and not speaking for them. So that was, you know, that's why the show was special, and that's the reason why he is still very loved. And you know, that show, for people, often people end up seeing it on YouTube clips, but there's a reason why that show still kind of lives on. Like, it was a really unique moment.
Yes.
Brief, but certainly it was powerful and unique and pretty damn funny.
Definitely. You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm guest host Sarika Mehta. If you missed any of this show, you can hear it again on stageandstudio.org. I'm speaking with Hari Kondabolu, New York-based comedian who will be performing here in Portland at the Helium Comedy Club September 25th, 26th, and 27th. His album, which is called Waiting for 2042, is on sale now.
People always say I'm obsessed with race. You're obsessed with race. You're obsessed with racism. You can't be obsessed with race in America. There's racist stuff that happens all the time. You can't be saying that I'm obsessed with race and racism in America is like saying I'm obsessed with swimming when I'm drowning. You know what I mean? It's absurd. I'm not the one who's obsessed. This country is obsessed. I hear about the year 2042 all the time on the news. 2042, for those of you who don't know, 2042, apparently, according to census figures, is the year that white people will be the minority in this country, right? White people will be 49% in 2042. And I don't know if there are people in this audience that are upset by this, but don't worry, white people. You were the minority when you came to this country. Things seem to have worked out for you, right? But here's the bigger point. Here's the more important point. 49% doesn't make you the minority, right? That's not how math works, right? 49% white only makes you the minority if you think the other 51% are exactly the same. That only works if you think, well, it's 49% white people and 51% you people. That's the only way. Because that 51%, my friends, is not a united front, okay? Just ask a black guy and a Korean guy what happens when the black guy walks into the Korean guy's store, okay? I bet you that interaction isn't pleasant. I bet you that interaction isn't like, hey, teammate, how's it going, teammate? Pretty good, am I right? 2042, you know, that's not what's happening. It's not what's happening. It's not a united front. There is some historic tension there. And some of you might be thinking, well, you're saying that 51% is not exactly the same, but you're assuming that all white people are the same. Yes. No. No. I'm joking. I'm obviously joking, right? Why am I joking? Because white isn't a thing. Race isn't a thing. It's all made up. It's a social construct. It's a way to separate us and destroy us, right? It's not real. White isn't a thing, and we know this, right? There used to be signs in New York that said no Irish, no blacks, no dogs. The Irish weren't white. The Polish weren't white. The Italians weren't white. The Jews weren't white. It's made up. It's a way to separate us. And you know, is there people of color in this room? You know, when you ask your white friends what their cultural heritage is, they never just say white. No, they give you a math equation. I'm a third German and a fourth Irish and 1/16th Welsh. It's like, damn, Steve, all these years I thought you were just white. My bad. I should have been more sensitive.
I always enjoy that one as well. Well, that
it's
is
a good piece. It's funny. I haven't, these are my jokes, but I haven't heard some of them in a while. I haven't done some of these in a while because once I put them on the album, you kind of start moving to other stuff. So it's like, oh yeah, that was good. That was a good one. Yeah.
Well, you know, that was from your album, which is called Waiting for 2042, the title track, so to speak. And as you mentioned, this is the year that white people will be the minority in the United States. I guess, first, what inspired this joke? What, I know that you're saying, you know, that it's what the media is obsessed with and everyone's talking about, but what exactly led you to this point?
I mean, I kept hearing that 2042 or whatever year they would say at that particular time. I think 2042 was the last one I ended up hearing when I wrote the joke, and I also like the ring of that 2042. Something about that sounded great, but I got sick of hearing it because it's like, why is this a thing? You know, why is this a thing people are fearing? And the fact the media keeps talking about it like an event, and they were talking about it the way that we talked about like the year 2000 or and who knows when. You know, people are going to, there's going to be chaos, like Y2K, there's going to be chaos and everything's going to be different. Like there was a hysteria, it almost seems, that's implied in this year becoming this thing that we have to count down to. And it came with all these implications that like, and inferences that like people never bothered to really think about. Like, what does white mean? And is that really a thing? Or, you know, why are we counting all non-white people as the same thing? Like, we're othering people, like, literally saying, like, you know, whites, with it, so that's just the assumption that everybody else is the same then. And it just kept, and plus this idea of, like, I have been the only brown person, only person of color, only brown person, Indian person in so many situations. And that's part of my norm. I have to deal with it. And I think it's interesting when all of a sudden there is the fear that you might be a minority in a situation that's newsworthy. Why is that newsworthy? And so that's why I think it was very bizarre to like hear that over and over again. And luckily I feel like, well, this is, you know, I heard that and I'm like, no one else is going to have a take on this. This is completely in my wheelhouse. And I started writing and, you know, there's certain things on the album where, you know, I was really obsessed with certain things, like certain things I'd hear and I'd get really annoyed with. And that was one of those things where I just kept thinking about that story about the year that white people leave in minority. Same thing when with the whole phenomenon of people saying that they're moving to Canada. I wrote about that on the album,
right,
too. Like, so many years of hearing people who I like and are friends with saying that, oh, if this happens, I'm moving to Canada. As if that, you know, it's an expression. It became almost a thing you say. And it's like, how is that, how is cowardice something that we've, you know, is accepted? You know, like, hey, you know, I'm a liberal, so if I don't get what I want, I'm running away. Like, that's your big slogan. That's your, you know, that's your default thing to say when you don't like how an election goes.
And you find solidarity in it.
You find solidarity about we're always going to move to Canada. It's like, oh, you know who doesn't get to move to Canada? Most people who right. don't have access to income. Like, there are people who don't get to leave the ghetto. Like, you want to leave the country? Like, the privilege that's in there. So, I mean, that's another thing about the album. Like, I feel like it's a very aggressive album, and I think a lot of people said, well, you're performing for the choir, and to some degree I think it was in Oakland. It's a very like excited crowd, mm-hmm. like very excited that I'm saying what I'm saying. And it was right after the Trayvon verdict had come out, and Oakland was pretty much on fire the week before, because you know, between Fruitvale coming out and you know, there was protests and you know, fights with the cops, and I was performing really up the block from all this stuff right after, you know, it had happened. And I think the crowd kind of reflected the energy of that part of Oakland at that time. And so the album certainly has a lot of fire, and a lot of people were excited I'm saying what I'm saying. But there's also moments where I think I'm like fairly critical, whether it's the Moving to Canada piece, critical of the left. And I'm talking about the left broadly, you know, it's a very broad term, but of sections of the left, as well as, like, you know, the clip that you all just played of that 2042 clip, I believe was the clip from YouTube. But the clip off the album, I think, is interesting because I actually yell at my audience.
Like, yes, I do remember that in the album. Actually, I wanted to ask you about different audiences that you perform for, because the first joke we aired on this show was taken from when you were on David Letterman, which is not the same audience as your Oakland audience for your album.
Sure.
Well, first of all, I'm curious how the audience received your comedy, and how do you kind of manage the audience, or various audiences?
Which particular audience?
The David Letterman audience.
Well, the Letterman audience, it's a mainstream audience. You know, it's not a universal audience, but definitely a lot of people that come because Dave, that's a big show. It's a CBS show. It's Letterman. It's an institution. It's Ed Sullivan Theater. It's New York. There's a lot of reasons why that show is, a show that everybody wants to go to, and it was a privilege and a big moment for me to be on that show. But that's not necessarily an audience that comes to see me. That's an audience. And so I think there are people in that crowd that certainly liked what I was doing, and there's certainly people who didn't know what to do with it. And maybe for some people it was like, I think clapping was easier than not, like, I think there were moments where I'm like, I guess we clap now. I don't know what to do with this guy's material. But certainly it was nice to hear people laugh. Like, there were people who got things, and also that set was one of my harder sets on TV. Like, that might have been the hardest set I've ever. So that is definitely the hardest set I've done on TV. Like, in terms of content, like, I didn't, I didn't simplify it. Like, I went for the things I wanted to go for, and the Letterman bookers really were like, do what you do, and we really love this material, and we think it's interesting. And for me, it felt like a complete race set, but they didn't care. They wanted that. Certainly, like, that wasn't the easiest set to do for that situation, but it worked. But certainly, no, it's not like a crowd that comes to see me or a crowd on the record. Crowds that come to see me, they're pretty much on board with most of the stuff I have to say. And at that point, it's a matter of, like, okay, well, then how do I make it more interesting? And also, I think there's a value to, like, sometimes the choir is tired. They're beaten down. Sometimes the folks that are with you are just, you're the only place they can go to. I have a lot of folks who are like organizers and teachers and students, or people who very much care about these things. And so they might agree for the most part with a lot of the stuff. But, like, it's also like the idea of, I think that's something as an organizer, former organizer, I know, like, sometimes it was hard to laugh. And sometimes you're weighed down by so much. The idea that you go to a place where you can have catharsis and laugh, that's something I'm not going to get out of a Letterman audience. But that certain, thank God you said it, laugh, yeah, I'll get that out of an audience that comes to see me.
That's a really good point. The ability to laugh when we are weighed down by so much versus breaking out a new
healthy
audience into this.
And I think
style.
It's hard also. I think I know my crowds also struggle with, they've never been to a comedy show before. They don't know how they work. I have people who snap when they like a joke, or they don't always laugh. And that's always frustrating for me, because it's like, I don't need your snaps. I just want you to laugh. It's like it's a very straightforward transaction. This isn't slam poetry. It's words for laughter. So I have to deal with certain unique things that other comedians might not have to deal with. But at the same time, I know you deal with that, but you also deal with an audience that will come back, and they actually do very much appreciate what you have to say. And, you do get a certain kind of laugh. There's a certain type of laugh I can hear, which is the cathartic, like, it feels good to get that out. And for me, it feels good to know that I'm not crazy. And despite the fact that, like, society makes you feel that you're crazy for having certain points of view and for questioning authority and for questioning what you're being fed, and to be able to actually say it out loud, which is already freeing, and have people respond positively, it's an incredible privilege to be a performer who has that opportunity.
Absolutely. I'm so sorry we have to wrap up. We're out of time. That's comedian Hari Kondabolu joining us by phone from New York. He'll be performing in Portland on September 25th, 26th, and 27th at the Helium Comedy Club. Hari Kondabolu, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful. Thank you.
Absolutely. That's it for Stage and Studio. Thanks to KBOO engineer Janet Anderson. If you missed any of the show, visit stageandstudio.org. You can also download shows at iTunes. And don't forget to like us on facebook.com/stage_studio or tweet us at @stage_studio. I'm Sarika Mehta, sitting in for Dime Roberts. Thanks so much for listening. You must be crazy.
Come one, come all to the KBOO Community Radio Book and Record Sale, Sunday, September 14th, from 9 a.m., when the KBOO members only are allowed during the first hour of the sale, and then from 10 a.m. till 5 p.m., everyone can take advantage of truly interesting and unusual books, records, CDs, tapes, videos, DVDs, whatever else has been donated. The sale will take place this year at the Volunteers of America Building, 537 Southeast Alder in Portland. Remember, all sales benefit your community radio station. For more information about the annual book and record sale, look at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. And don't forget to tune in to KBOO Friday night at midnight for the Broken Record Show, an offbeat sound patchwork composed entirely from items for the sale and served up by various KBOO disc jockeys and voices. That's the Broken Record Show, Friday night, September 12th from midnight till 3 a.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Have a go, and let there be a gallery, put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream, and him on my wall.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week is Kristen Kennedy, the visual art curator for PICA, the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art. Kristen's here to talk